Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Zelensky mania has run its course. Interest in the proxy war in Russia is fading. Kiev's once hyped counteroffensive is a bust. Whispers and rumors suggest there are those in the West who believe the time is coming to pull the plug on Zelensky. This was always inevitable. Crosstalking Ukraine, I'm joined by my guest Nikolai Petro in Kingston. He's professor of political science at the University of Rhode Island. In Seattle, we have Sarah Bills. She is a former U.S. Navy service member, a geopolitical analyst, and one of the hosts of DD Geopolitics. And here in Moscow, we have Brad Blankenship. He is a journalist, a columnist for RT, as well as a regular contributor to CGTN and Global Times. All right, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Nikolai, let me go to you first. You know, I'm sure you came across these articles in Time and The Economist. You know, very mainstream, particularly The Economist, is very much establishment. And it's painting a very gloomy picture about Ukraine's plight during this conflict with Russia, or I should say NATO's conflict with Russia. Where is this all going? I mean, is this signaling something? Go ahead.
I think it is. Once you get something published in one of those, as a matter of fact, there's something along the same lines in Foreign Affairs, a short piece of this week as well. It's very much a matter of the establishment signaling that it wants to cut you loose.
Well, I mean, but, you know, Nikolai, let me stay with you. I mean, cut you loose, cut Ukraine loose or Zelensky loose or both?
Zelensky first, because, you know, 100-odd billion is not chump change. So we've invested that. We have a sunken cost, if you will, for NATO and especially the United States in Ukraine. This is this war didn't happen 2 years ago. It didn't even start in 2014. It has a long pedigree, much of which was laid out by former Jimmy Carter's national security advisor, Zbigniew Brzezinski. So that strategy, I think, is still the ideal strategy for the United States, that of creating an, well, as Putin put it, an anti-Russia right at Russia's doorstep, and making sure that it is well-armed and acts as a deterrent to Russia. So that's going to continue. So the first step is, of course, to get rid of Zelensky, who is proving to be someone not up to the task.
Yeah. Well, you're being very gentle in your language, but because this is television, I won't express my exact opinion. Sarah, let me... He's a nuisance, let's say it. At least he's that, okay? He's the panhandler, okay? Sarah, but I mean, you know, for a lot of us, it's been apparent that Ukraine was never going to win this conflict. Actually, I think for most of us, we were looking at how NATO is going to react to it, not Ukraine, because NATO doesn't give a hoot about Ukraine, really. Certainly not about its people, okay? But Sarah, it doesn't preclude some kind of frozen conflict. Yeah, as Nikolai's pointed out, you know, $100+ billion, that's not chump change, but, you know, $3 billion a year like they were giving to Israel, that's, as, you know, some would say, Lindsey Graham, that's the best money we've ever spent. Go ahead, Sarah.
Well, I keep hearing about this frozen conflict idea in analyst circles and some media outlets. But when I think about frozen conflict, I think of Korea. And I don't believe that's a viable solution for Ukraine, for this conflict and for this region in particular. The reason why I think the United States might want a frozen conflict scenario is because it would keep their foot in the door in Eastern Europe, which is not a good idea for Eastern Europe at all. Giving them another open door through which they can sow conflict, stage coups, whatever else they want to destabilize.
Sarah, very much like Syria, you know, I mean, U.S. troops are there illegally, and I'm not saying U.S. troops would go into Ukraine, at least not at this point, but it's to keep a quagmire there.
Exactly.
at low cost and irritate and keep the attention of the Russians. Brad, let me throw it to you here in Moscow. What are your thoughts?
You know, one thing that I think is really interesting now about this conflict, because we've seen now recent reports in MSNBC that are talking about the fact that apparently Western leaders are now telling the Ukrainian authorities that they should start to think about some peace proposal to bring to the table. And what I find so interesting about this now is that apparently, you know, Joe Biden and other Western leaders are considering the fact that maybe, you know, we should, you know, have a peaceful resolution to the conflict, something that a lot of us have been saying since the beginning. You know, those of us who actually care about the Ukrainian people and their lives and don't want it to them to just be sacrificed on the altar of Washington's dominion. And I hear a lot speculated about what will this include. You know, what would a possible peace scenario look like, a frozen conflict, blah, blah, whatever. What's interesting to me now to look about to look at the situation is this. Will Russia accept this?
Well,
that's something that nobody's talking about. Nobody's talking about the fact that Russia is actually winning this war, and maybe they don't even need to play ball with the West on this because they will just win it anyways. Because let's face it, Ukraine is having trouble getting troops just to the front line. All of these Wunder weapons we keep hearing about that are going to the front lines are just not working. It's all total PR propaganda for the weapons contractors. And now there's a conflict in Israel and Palestine. The West doesn't have the enthusiasm to support Ukraine. So I'm just wondering, and I've seen Russian analysts and writers talk about this. It's like, should we even play ball with him? I hope that there's a peaceful resolution to this. But I think that the ball's really in Russia's court now.
Let me throw that to Nikolai. Nikolai, look, I can remember the first few months of the conflict, and there were some people that thought they were enlightened and said, we need a new Minsk agreement. Well, why do we need a new one when the first two failed and they were sabotaged here? My point, Nikolai, is why would Russia trust any kind of Western interlocutor at this point in time? Because this isn't a stalemate. No, Russia's aim, one of its major aims, is to degrade the Ukrainian military. It is doing that exactly. So why would Russia sit down at the table? Nikolai.
In the long run, conflict is not to anyone's advantage, including Russia. Ultimately, what all sides agree needs to happen, whether they acknowledge it now or not, is good neighborly relations between Ukraine and Russia. There is no way Ukraine as a state can survive without that. So I think the point made earlier that the ball is in Russia's court is correct. But it is in Russia's interests, which is also, by the way, losing materiel and manpower that it could better use elsewhere. It is in Russia's interest to end this conflict, but I think the table has shifted now so that it will have to be more on Russia's terms. So it becomes increasingly important to understand what Russia's terms are for ending this conflict.
Well, Sarah, the big problem for me in all of this is culminating what we've said thus far on this program, is that Russia is not going to allow some kind of ceasefire and let Ukraine build up through NATO and start it all over again. It has to be much more of a definitive outcome. No NATO membership, a change in regime in Kiev. Those are kind of security guarantees that Russia wants, because as Brad has already pointed out here, nobody ever thinks about what the Russians want. Go ahead, Sarah.
Well, even just the talk of ceasefire and frozen conflict, it covers up the fact that Russia is making consistent gains around the Avdiivka and Kupiansk area. So while everyone's kind of conflicting about ceasefires and frozen conflicts, Russia continues to chip away at land. Even the morale videos have changed in tone to where, we will be buying apartments in Kiev and Lviv. We don't know what Russia can do now that the attention is taken completely off of Ukraine and shifted to Israel. And those peace terms might even change to push all the way out into Western Ukraine. At this point, I think the ball is in Russia's court, and they're the ones that are able to determine the destiny of this conflict, because we're just wrapped up in the other one at this point.
Well, Brad, let me go back to you here in Moscow. I mean, in reading closely the Time magazine article, Zelensky is not someone you can negotiate with, because I think, if I'm not mistaken, even they used the word delusional.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. You know, he's been surrounded by so many yes men and fanatics, people telling him, especially this Washington crowd and a lot of these think tank folks and celebrities and so on that he surrounds himself in the West, that tell him that he's able to do anything he wants, that the peace terms for the Ukraine conflict will include getting back all of the territory that Ukraine claims, including Crimea. But as I said before, I mean, this is not the reality. I mean, if your real objective as a Ukrainian leader in this conflict is to say this, your nation will be annihilated. And I hate to speak in such stark terms, but I mean, that's just the reality of it. And this is why I think that people need to really seriously consider Russia's position on this. And I think that whether they like it or not, they're going to have to do that. You know, you mentioned before that there's maybe some idea we'll go back to another Minsk Accord or something, but this isn't going to work. I mean, you know, there was already an attempt for the West to mediate this conflict, and it just didn't work. You know, and like I said, the ball's really in Russia's court to decide the course of this, because the West is losing enthusiasm for this, let's face it. Now, they're the ones, Russia, I mean, Moscow is the one dictating this conflict. They're the ones who are going to be able to decide how it plays out and what are realistic terms. And I think that's just the really unfortunate part about this, because as much as these fanatics in the West that have surrounded Zelensky that have told him, yeah, we'll get you everything back, you know, all the Donbass, we'll get you Crimea. Now, apparently, they're telling him now, yeah, you might actually have to give up, you know, like significant territory of your country, and you might have to just give that up. And if he's willing, unwilling to listen to the reality, I just think that he just cannot be the president of Ukraine. I mean, I saw a recent opposition leader.
Hang on here, name, Brad.
He's living in Russia now, but he said that he might be the last Ukrainian leader.
We have a slight time delay here. I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue more discussion on Ukraine. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter LaBelle. To remind you, we're discussing Ukraine. Let's go back to Nikolai in Kingston. Viewers of this program know I've been quite passionate about covering this conflict and trying to, you know, flesh out different ideas and what directions it can go. But I appreciate, Nikolai, your passion as well, because when this conflict comes to an end, we all want it to come to an end. But what role will the West play in that? Will they drop the sanctions? Probably not, okay? Will they find ways to integrate Ukraine into some kind of security arrangement? Probably yes. Russia will still remain the enemy. How do we get away from that paradigm? Why can't we have the indivisibility of security for all? Is that something realistic to think about?
It will have to become a reality, and that is the path. That is the way to truly settling this conflict. As has been mentioned before, both sides, well, all interlocutors, there are more than two sides here, all the parties distrust each other. The solution is rather obvious, because we've had these kind of internecine as well as pan-European conflicts before, and we gave them very appropriate names, 30 years war, 100 years war. This is a war along the same lines. And the solution, obviously, is a large-scale pan-European peace conference. To sum it up quickly, the solution is not another Minsk. It's a renewed and invigorated Helsinki format.
Well, Nikolai, I mean, do you think the Americans will go along with that? I mean, if the Americans, you know, were to suggest it, maybe it would work for Europe, but they're the ones that would object to it, okay? I mean, American hegemony doesn't just, you know, say, well, I'm done, I'm picking up my marbles and I'm going to go home. That's not going to happen. Let me throw this to Sarah here. Obviously, what Nikolai is saying is absolutely right, but since the end of the Cold War, you had a security arrangement not only without Russia, but against Russia. How do we change that?
You can't. I mean, the United States needs to have its boogeyman. And for right now, for the foreseeable future, it's going to be Russia. We still haven't accepted here Russia's immense contributions to World War II. We're not going to accept Russia's winning and dictating the peace terms of this conflict. It's just not something that's going to happen.
Well, you know, Brad, it's very interesting. John Mearsheimer, the geopolitical thinker, he wrote a very interesting piece, I think now it's about 6 weeks ago, maybe 2 months ago, and he said that Russia will win, but it will be an ugly victory. I don't know if you came across that piece.
Yeah, I did. I mean, like I've been saying this whole time, it's obvious anyway you slice it, Russia is going to win the conflict, and it's going to be either messy or it's not going to be messy. I mean, there's either going to be a realistic peace term, which Nikolai was saying will have something to do with like a Helsinki format. I think, honestly, we need to look more long-term. You know, I've been living in Europe for 5 years. I live in the Czech Republic, so I understand. You know, I can see that when you apply somebody like Mearsheimer's philosophy, you can see that the realist philosophy works. You know, okay, there's a pure competitor power going into Russia's sphere of influence. This naturally creates tensions and so on. Yeah, I understand that. But we also need to think about people like the Czechs who, you know, when you have a country like Russia, who they have historical animosity towards, they're going to seek out another great power to protect them, that being the United States. I think we also, as much as I honestly do detest Czech politics, I think we need to actually take everybody's perspectives and, you know, give them respect and have a format for this. So we need to think larger. We need to have a security architecture that goes beyond just one format, but is a really thing that's, you know, goes beyond NATO. And this is, I hope, maybe people like Macron are talking about this, to have a security architecture that's maybe complementary to NATO, a bigger thing. Because we need, I mean, Europe has been the focal point of so many wars over the past centuries that have destroyed the entire world. We really need to have some kind of long-term security architecture in Europe to make sure that these wars don't go on longer. And I really look forward to the day this happens. About the United States not being a part of this, I think, personally, what's important to recognize about the United States is they're doing all of their capabilities that they have. They're using them at all times, what they call full spectrum dominance. If they're not winning somewhere, it's because they can't win. And I think we have a little bit of reverse kind of American exceptionalism where we think, oh, the United States could win, but they're just not putting in the effort. No, they're not. They can't. And I think things genuinely are changing, where if the United States doesn't want to be part of this, well, they can just shove it, honestly. I think Europe is going to move on, and the world's going to move on past America. And I look forward to that day. I really do.
Well, Nikolai, how does NATO acquit itself through all of this? Okay, because my perspective is, well, this conflict came about because NATO failed the peace, okay? And we can have an end of the conflict, as you point out, as all of us agree, on Russia's terms. But how does that, or how should it change NATO's perspective? Okay, you know, the out-of-area operations, expansion towards the east, does it put any kind of brake on it? Or is there, you know, don't like to use this kind of woke language, but is there a reimagination of NATO? Or should it just be shut down and, you know, start from scratch? Nikolai.
Well, I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon, this kind of reimagining. I suppose future historians will debate who the great loser was of this conflict. Of course, place of honor has to go to Ukraine itself, but not far behind will come Europe, the old Europe, and NATO. NATO has to be seen as the big loser in this conflict. And I think the expansion of NATO's agenda beyond Europe and outside of its traditional realm of defense is a sign of grasping and ultimately insecurity about its future mission.
You know, Sarah, one of the things that I really worry about, and I think maybe I'll surprise people, is that whenever there is some kind of conclusion, at least to the hot war that we're seeing in Ukraine, there's going to be retribution. Who lost the war? The stab in the back? Who got all the money? Where'd all the money go? It will probably be very, very ugly. Sarah.
I 100% agree. The fallout from this is going to be tremendous. Everything has gone into a complete tailspin with the corruption, the aid, the overall tone and action. There has been a no holds barred sort of methodology here in the United States, where it's give them everything they want and we'll ask questions later. Very much a United States foreign policy strategy, and that's where we're at now. We've started asking questions about where the money's gone. They don't know. We've started asking questions where the weapons gone. Maybe they're in the Middle East. We don't know. So the blowback from this is going to be tremendous. The reverberations are going to be enormous. And they're not just going to be amongst world leaders or governments. They're going to be within the populations as well, because there's going to be a lot of angry Ukrainian refugees.
Well, Sarah, to stay with you, I wonder how many refugees will actually come back, because you'll basically have a country of people that are disabled because of the war, and the elderly and the very, very poor. Sarah, in the Economist article, Zaluzhny, the general, he did not make reference to Zelensky at all, which is quite interesting. And the fact that the Economist profiled him so highly, it looks to me that he's the person the West is looking to push out Zelensky. He doesn't want to have an election. And they, what they have is a military junta anyway, so why not have a real general? Sarah, real quick before I go to Brad.
100%. I mean, even here, it's starting to be rumored that that the United States wants Zelensky to hold elections and that for Zaluzhny to eventually run. I just don't foresee that saving Ukraine. I mean, the jig is up. They're just kind of prolonging the inevitable at this point.
Yeah, let me go to Brad now. I think it's, I was going to say window dressing, but it's kind of like more like putting lipstick on a pig. Brad, I mean, they're looking for a way out. And I've said on this program before that they'll say, the Ukrainians won because we stopped the Russians before they made it to Paris. That's what they're going to say, Brad.
Yeah, they're going to rewrite the history of this to make themselves look better, but it is no doubt a strategic loss and a very, very crucial one, you know. And I just think it's very sad for Ukrainian people because, you know, I lived in Europe well before the conflict, and I do remember that there were many Ukrainians who came to the West looking for opportunities before the war. Ukraine was not a good country, and it never was, and it hasn't been for a long time. You know, since the fall of the Soviet Union, people were always coming to the West. And I remember when I first moved to Prague, people called them, and I'm just a little sick here, they called them the Mexicans of Europe. That's what people called them. And it's quite sad, you know, and I feel for the Ukrainians. You know, you talked about before about how many people are going to be left out. And they might not go back, probably because their country is going to be basically just a pit now, you know. And I think it's really sad. It didn't need to be like this. Nothing needed to be like this. And we could have had peace. We could have had a real security architecture that really brought in everybody's concerns, but that's just not the reality. And this falls completely on the lap of the United States. And I think that really this will reflect very poorly on the United States, the West, and the rest of the countries that are basically the U.S.'s lieutenants. And that's why I think that, you know, this is part and parcel with just the downfall of the United States of America as the number one world power. And while that's a very sad thing, the war in Ukraine, in the end, it's kind of a good thing because, you know, the beginning of a new multipolar era is going to be good for everybody, I think. It's going to be better for the world.
Nikolai, I give you the last 30 seconds. Go ahead.
Well, I just want to reiterate what I was saying before. There is a pathway to peace, but it will have to include all the parties. And I mentioned the idea several months ago of a new Treaty of Westphalia, because one of the things that we have to think about is the new meaning of sovereignty and territory and populations that need to be secured, which Russia has been advancing recently. The idea not only of nation states, but of civilizations and the obligations that we have under international law need to treat more seriously the interests of oppressed peoples everywhere. And all of that can only be dealt with in a multilateral, large-scale format where people can hash out their differences.
Well,
for as long
that's music. That's music to my viewers' ears. That's why people watch this program, to hear that kind of rational thinking. That's all the time we have. I want to thank my guests in Kingston, Seattle, and here in Moscow. And of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, Crosstalk Rules.